This programming is sponsored by the UH Health Family Care Center, offering primary care and behavioral health services on the University of Houston campus. Health insurance plans, including Medicare and Medicaid, accepted. New patient appointments and more at 832-UH-CARES.
This programming is sponsored by Linscomb Wealth, a wealth management firm partnering with individuals and families dedicated to helping them build, preserve, and manage wealth by creating a customized plan to work toward achieving their goals. More at LinscombWealth.com.
Okay, ready?
Let's do it. Welcome to Party Politics. I'm Jay Iyer, a political science professor from Texas Southern University.
And I'm Brandon Rottinghouse, a political science professor from the University of Houston. Hey, thanks for hanging out with us on an unusually busy week of political events. National, Texas, we've got 40 days to an election, Jay. We've got 1 month until early voting. We've got budget fights. We've got people going to jail. It's just the full panoply, right?
Yeah, big news for us this week here in Texas, of course, is we got the big three debates coming up between O'Rourke and Cruz.
What did you call it? The Thrill in Manila?
The Thrill in Manila. And you know those three, those Ollie Frazier fights? Right. You know, we got round one Friday night.
I love it.
And we're going to break that down and kind of what to expect. But before we get to that, let's go dive on into some of these national topics. Big one, of course, Paul Manafort took a plea, Brandon. What does this mean? We're wondering if he's going to cooperate. It looks like he's going to cooperate. Is this trouble for President Trump?
Trouble on the horizon. Yeah, we actually predicted something like this might happen because you can take the plea anytime before you get the guilty, which it was looking like was going to happen. So, like you say, this is Paul Manafort, the former campaign chairman, has basically conceded that he committed several federal crimes and has agreed to cooperate with the Justice Department. Some of these crimes include basically laundering about $60 million to avoid paying taxes. He is going to hand over five properties, Jay, including his Trump Tower prized condo, a mansion in the Hamptons, and three bank accounts and a big life insurance policy. I think that this is problematic for them because let's just take stock of where we are, right? You've got basically Trump's national security advisor, his campaign manager, his personal lawyer, former foreign policy counselor, who have all potentially giving some exculpatory information to Mueller. So this could be a serious impact on the White House and on the prosecutions therein. You have Dan McGahn, the White House attorney who is leaving. You also have effectively here Trump in the dark when it comes to what the special prosecutors know. So this all adds up to a poor legal defense from the White House, and everything else is just political, and that's not a good enough defense.
Well, yeah, again, I think the problem here for the president is that you've got this sort of cascading number of people that are now cooperating, and increasingly, you know, they don't make a deal unless there's evidence there that's going to benefit in a prosecution of someone else. And so as a consequence, I think the president, you know, as they say, has been lawyered up. And he's good to go and ready to go as far as defending himself. But whether or not they ultimately it results in a problem for the president individually, it's almost certain to result in more people being involved in this process. So I just think kind of going forward, it's a real problem for the president. And it dovetails exactly into some of the reaction that he's had. For example, Brandon, he has decided and asked to immediately declassify all documents related to the issuance of FISA warrants, the so-called FISA warrants that were put out for Carter Page in terms of ordering surveillance. He's asked for something that's pretty unprecedented. He was immediately declassifying it. He wants it out there. National security experts are extremely unhappy about this.
Yes, there's definite worry that too much is being offered here publicly. So like you said, yeah, DOJ has been ordered to declassify a bunch of material from the Russian investigation. To me, one of the more interesting components here is that some of this will be redacted text messages from several high-level Justice Department and FBI employees, including former Director James Comey, as well as Deputy Director Andrew McCabe. This continues this sort of political fight that the president is putting up. They need a smokescreen, Jay. Like I said, I mean, legally speaking, they're in danger. And the Trump legal team is in such disarray that I'm not sure they have a great legal strategy. So they've taken to the political strategy, which is really complicated. Internally, this is a big win for the Freedom Caucus because they were looking for the smokescreen for a long time. And now the president has given them that cover. So if they can discredit the Mueller investigation, then it definitely puts a damper on what might happen, but also potentially gives cover like to Trump for maybe pardoning Manafort or others involved to maybe make it so that they won't give information to Mueller. The plea deal Manafort took seems to limit that and provide an opportunity for him to keep some property if he doesn't take that clemency. But there are still other people involved, so there's still a legal political game here afoot.
I think this would not have happened, but for the fact that you've had Manafort and others starting to cooperate more. The president clearly, as you said, is trying to muddy the waters here, trying to get into a situation where you're assuming that this is essentially a political witch hunt, which is really what he wants, to try to undermine sort of the credibility of it. Again, I'm not sure he's going to succeed if you just have cascades amount of information.
Yeah.
The big issue to me is this. I still don't believe ultimately that the president is the one that's going to be at fault here, yeah. But it's some of the people around him, potentially in his immediate family,
yes.
which is the real problem for him.
They'll fall on their sword for him, right? And this is not uncommon for presidents, but definitely the danger is not at the presidential level, but just below that. That has an effect, though, on the president, right? And we know that when the family is involved, he gets really sticky. So,
well, Brandon, I want to shift gears a little bit and talk about this because you have talked about the level of scandal in this White House is reaching unprecedented levels. We got one more coming up here. FEMA Director Brock Long is now being investigated for personal use of funds specifically related to transport to and from his house in North Carolina. This is coming at a time where he is front and center with the recovery efforts in North Carolina.
Yeah.
What's going on here?
Yeah, Brock Long and two other federal employees have broken potentially multiple laws in their use of government resources. So, Jay, to me, the swamp remains squishy, right? Now, Trump promised to drain it. It seems like there's still this legacy and there are still these moments that aren't being dealt with. So just like Jimmy Carter, frankly, before him, the promise to clean up government is a lot easier to say than to do. So ultimately, most officials survive this. Cabinet officials tend to be in greater jeopardy of losing their job than others. But these investigations can take a while. So on average, it's about 200 to 300 days. That means, Jay, it's going to cross over the 2018 election, but it's also possibly going to affect the 2020 primary cycle. Any challenge to the president could be from his own party, and it could be based upon just the credibility of the administration and the efficiency of government. So these scandals could have a lasting, lingering effect.
Well, speaking of money and funds, Brandon, the Supreme Court of the United States came out with a really massive ruling, and in any other week, this might be the big issue, but not in this one. They have essentially shined a light on something called dark money, money that corporations have been able to sort of funnel through nonprofits that has before been unreported. They're now saying you have to report the disclosure of who is giving when it's for an explicit political purpose.
Yeah, this was sort of a regulatory loophole at the Federal Election Commission, right? And this actually was reported by NPR. They found that essentially that some organizations didn't have to register as a political committee with the commission and therefore didn't have to disclose donors unless that specific donor earmarked money for an ad. So this is something which potentially has groundbreaking effect on the shining of light on dark money and really could affect this cycle because we're still not quite there yet, even though it feels like we're, you know, every day, you know, waist deep in it. But it certainly will affect 2020, where we're going to have a massive amount, billions of dollars spent on the presidential.
Brandon, the big national news over the last couple of weeks has been the movement to try and confirm Brett Kavanaugh. Judge Kavanaugh is the nominee to serve on the United States Supreme Court. We had a sort of a massive bombshell that dropped. Judge Kavanaugh was accused of sexual misconduct when he was 17 years old. His accuser, Dr. Christine Ford, has come forward, and it's created a huge issue here, both as far as the larger issues related to the Me Too movement and how this is to be treated. And just from a political perspective, Brandon, the ability of Brett Kavanaugh to be confirmed is now suddenly thrown into question.
Yeah, I want to get your take on this because I want to get a sense of whether or not you think this is going to have an effect. I'm not sure it does. I think it makes the vote a little harder to swallow than it was before for Senators Collins and Murkowski, but I'm not sure it dramatically affects the outcome. But I think what is clear, though, is that the charges need to be taken seriously and slowly. In the past, when this happened to Clarence Thomas, the people who ended up looking the worst were the people who were driving the process, especially the senators, right? So Joe Biden in particular looked quite bad. So I think that it needs to be handled carefully. And that's really going to be the determinant as to how it affects Kavanaugh or not. I think ultimately, politically, it gives some cover to conservative Democrats like Senator Donnelly and Manchin and McCaskill, who would have to take a tough vote if this was free and clear and maybe never came up. So although I don't think it'll change their vote, I do think it gives them a little bit of political cover going forward. But what do you think? How does it affect the nomination? And is the White House going to pull it? Are they going to back him? What's going on?
Yeah, to me, the big issue is time. And I think that's the biggest variable here, because we've got the midterm elections coming up. And that's the biggest issue, because they recognize that there's a very real likelihood that the U.S. Senate could change hands party-wise. If that were to happen, the nomination would clearly be in jeopardy if this is carried over afterwards. So we've got an issue of the clock. So part of it as a practical matter is I think everyone agrees that Dr. Ford should be given the ability to publicly testify before this committee. Her lawyers have now come back and said that they believe that the FBI should first investigate this, and then she would testify. I think the argument there is that it verifies and makes credible her underlying claim.
Yes.
And I think her willingness to do that probably bolsters her claim, certainly in the eyes of many, but it elongates the process. If you start going into November with this, or October, it becomes very, very hard to have a confirmation process in what would otherwise be the middle of the election cycle. And then you run into a situation where you're trying to confirm him during a lame duck session, which will create all sorts of problems, particularly if she's proven credible. If you pull this down, you may not have time, if you're the Republicans, to renominate someone else and get he or she through the process by the end of the midterms.
No chance, right? No, they've got to be able to get this or nothing at this point. And I think you're right. The argument politically about doing something in the interim would be treated the way that the Republicans treated the President Obama's nominee for the Supreme Court, right? So they would say, we need to push this off. So I think that they basically turn those tables politically and then nothing would happen. So I think that it's going to be an interesting couple of weeks. We'll see how this ends up, but it definitely is the case that this is going to be the big issue in the next couple of weeks, motivating much of what happens in the midterm election. So let's talk Texas, Jay. Lots going on in the Lone Star State this week, including former Land Commissioner Jerry Patterson is endorsing a Democrat?
That's right. That's right. You know, political blood feuds can run deep here in Texas, Brandon.
Yes.
And Republican Jerry Patterson, who has had this longstanding, I don't even call it rivalry, just dislike for what his successor, Land Commissioner George P. Bush, has been doing with the land office, both as it relates to disaster recovery and as it relates to Texas history, and the Alamo in particular, has decided to endorse his Democratic opponent, Miguel Suazo, for land commissioner. Politically, not that much, I think, going on. Suazo is a credible candidate, but isn't really doing much. I don't think George P. Bush is in much danger, but this is just kind of a shot across the bow and try to embarrass George P. here and hurt him.
Yeah. It could potentially give Suazo a little bump. Maybe you're going to find some people giving him a second look, but I think you're right. George P. Bush is pretty insulated from much of that. I'll throw one more in there, Jay, and that is that Bennett Ratliff, a former Republican member of the legislature, endorsed Julie Johnson, who's a Democrat, running against Matt Rinaldi, a Republican in House District 115. So you've got a little bit of a kind of a Republican versus Republican infighting, which is not that uncommon, but I don't know that it means that there's like a third party per se, but there's certainly a third avenue. And I think this is going to happen more. On Patterson, I think that there are two things we know about Jerry Patterson. Number one, he's definitely carrying a gun right now. And number two, he is epically good at holding a grudge. So we're going to see, I think, this fight continue as long as George P. Bush is in office.
Well, shifting gears a little bit, the president has decided to once again weigh in on Texas politics.
Yeah.
And inexplicably is decided to insert himself in a really swing district, one in which he lost. He's decided to endorse Congressman Pete Sessions from the Dallas area, who is locked in a heated battle against Colin Allred, the Democrat. I don't think this is a particularly smart thing to do for the president. I'm not quite sure I even understand what this is about.
It's a good question. I'm not really sure Sessions would have asked for this. Now, if it was going to help with fundraising, maybe, but I think that an endorsement like this in this district is probably worse than a non-endorsement, right? That district is changing significantly. You've got a younger, more ethnically and racially diverse group of voters moving in, and Allred is running a really good campaign, very well funded. Now, remember, last week we had George W. Bush in the district raising money for Pete Sessions. So they know, Republicans know, this is a seat that's potentially in danger of flipping. But I don't think Trump is the right spokesperson to come make that happen.
Yeah, well, the issue there is George W. Bush is popular in that district.
Right.
He's from Dallas.
It's his district,
and
right,
it makes a ton of sense. This is a situation where you've got the president who is not particularly popular in the district endorsing someone who is also maybe not the most popular incumbent. So I'm not sure I understand the logic here. But again, you know, I think sometimes when the president wants to lay his endorsement, you take it and you just kind of move on.
I think that's right. You know, and I do think, honestly, that the Republicans have gotten some traction in leaning on Donald Trump. His numbers for Republicans are really good. So I'm not certain that the kind of very conservative strategy is hurting most Republicans, but in that district, I think it actually might hurt Sessions. And honestly, if you don't do anything to take advantage of it anyway, then what's the point? It simply just lays there. So I'm not sure what to make of it yet. We'll see.
Well, Brandon, the State Board of Education has finally, after many iterations, ratified the creation of a Mexican-American Studies course. Although they had sort of changed the name up a bit, it's finally here. It's been a long time coming. What are your thoughts?
I think this is a good sign. I think that the state needs to appreciate its history, and learning from each other and each other's culture is exactly what needs to happen. Ignoring that heritage is like ignoring the history of Texas. And so having this is good. The fights were, I think, just like every other fight for the State Board of Education. They tended to the political in a way that was unnecessary and counterproductive. So I think this is a good outcome. And frankly, I'd love to take this class, right?
Yeah, I think it's a great class. I think we were talking about it earlier.
Yeah.
My one caveat is, I would love for there to be Mexican-American Studies modules in the existing curriculum.
Yeah.
I just think the general history courses need to be more reflective. You and I teach, and we talk about this a lot. We need to be able to have the totality of the state embedded within the education curriculum, not necessarily have it segmented out. But you know what? A win is a win, and I think people will take this. Speaking of a win is a win, Brandon, I think I owe you a puppy taco.
And I will take it because I love puppy tacos, right?
Well, the Democrats in the San Antonio area are probably woke up Wednesday morning and were very, very unhappy because Democrat Pete Gallego lost in the Battle of the Petes to Republican Pete Flores, a big upset in a reliably Democratic Senate seat. What happened?
Wow. I think a lot of things went wrong for the Democrats. Like you say, a lot of Democrats woke up to this news, and most of them didn't vote, right? You have here Pete Flores, a Republican who had run against Carlos Uresti in the last election, running again in the special election to replace Senator Uresti, who is under indictment and has been convicted. So this is a district which is, like you say, reliably Democratic. And I think what you had here is just complacency as the real culprit. The Democrats didn't turn out. Now, it's a low turnout election in general because it's a special. It's an off cycle. It's forgotten about by most people. But you know who didn't forget it? The Republicans, right? Because you had Abbott and you had Patrick spending a bunch of money. You had a bunch of doors knocked on. And I think that this is potentially a major problem for the Democrats. Gallego was an inspiring as such, right? He's not Beto, but he ended up with about $150,000 in the bank. Why not spend that money? Get your votes out. Do some ads. The lackluster performance here, I think, suggests that the blue wave requires a hero and a villain. And they may have had a villain, even though Flores wasn't terribly disliked by Republicans or by Democrats. But Gallego wasn't a hero. And I question whether or not this is going to have any long-term effect and what the blue wave looks like. And you know who else is really worried? Gina Ortiz-Jones, right? Who's running in the 23rd congressional district.
Yeah, I think Will Hurd must be dancing a jig this morning because you look at these numbers and it definitely indicates that his race is definitely more in play than I think some people think. But I will say this. I think the one thing about the blue wave is that blue wave needs to be a multicolored wave for Democrats to be successful. You have to have turnout, not just among sort of affluent and progressive Anglos who are really energized, but you've got to get African-Americans and Latinos and Asian-Americans, and the multiracial coalition that's become the modern Democratic Party has to show up and vote. Pete Gallego lost largely because reliably Democratic Latino voters just didn't vote. And that's a huge problem for them. And it's going to ultimately create a problem, and no matter how popular Beto O'Rourke is, He can't lift all the boats up himself. They're going to need to do more as far as trying to turn it out, particularly at these micro, county, and targeted levels.
And where it's close, 2,000 votes, right? Democrats couldn't come up with in a district that's been blue since Reconstruction. So this is, I think, an ongoing issue, but you're exactly right. You cannot win if you don't organize, and they took it for granted, and it went south. Well, taking for granted is something that we hope not to do in Texas because we like to stay true to our roots. We stay true to our heroes, Jay. But Willie Nelson, the great Willie Nelson, the redheaded stranger, Jay, got into some trouble this week. What happened?
Well, Willie Nelson had decided to do a benefit concert for Beto O'Rourke. And inexplicably, anyone in the state of Texas who considers themselves a Willie Nelson fan must know a bunch of things about him, not the least of which is he's a liberal man, a very liberal man, famous for being a shall we say, frequent user of cannabis. In addition to
what
that,
what are you trying to say?
Yeah, what am I trying to say? In addition to that, I mean, he has supported progressive causes for years, famously created Farm Aid years ago, endorsed Jim Hightower for ag commissioner. He's always supported progressive causes. Suddenly, a group of people are feeling betrayed that he's supporting Beto O'Rourke. My quick take is they're either Russian bots or they're not really Willie Nelson fans, and he shouldn't really care.
I agree. This, if we're to choose a song, Jay, maybe it's Blue Eyes Crying in the Rain, right? What are you crying about, right? You knew Willie was a liberal. He smoked weed on the roof of the White House when Carter was president, and he famously brags about it. This is not news, but it definitely shows the polarization in the state on this issue. And it's only going to get worse, especially on barbecue, Jay.
Oh, yes. Apparently, speaking of polarization, Senator Cruz is out there telling people that if Beto O'Rourke is elected, barbecue will be illegal in Texas. How is this even possible?
He was joking, but again, it shows the sort of like polarization that we find. To be honest, barbecue tofu sounds like something I would try. Now, I'm as big a Texan as the next, and I would think this would taste pretty good if you
actually
could do
I've
it,
had
right?
barbecue
Have
tofu,
you?
And it's fantastic. I strongly recommend it. It is a great thing. Well, speaking of Beto and Ted, let's take a quick break. When we come back, we are going to dive into the big three debates coming up, one Friday night, and of course one at the University of Houston a week later. It's going to be a fun time, Brandon. Let's take a quick break, come back, talk some debates.
Jay, like you said, the big news of the week is that you have three scheduled debates for the blockbuster Texas Senate race, which has really turned into something that's national in scale. So let's talk a little bit about sort of what we expect and maybe a little bit about what each of the campaigns and candidates has to do in these debates as a preview.
Yeah, so let's break it down. I'll start with Senator Cruz. I think he needs to get out there and show that he is representing of Texas values. That's what he wants to do. He's looking to, I think, paint a picture of his opponent as someone more progressive and out of step with Texas. He's going to try to define Beto O'Rourke on that stage. He's going to talk about what he has done. But I think his real goal is to just shine a pretty bright spotlight on what he thinks is a very progressive opponent.
Yeah. And you think that'll work?
I don't, because I do think, you know, to me, the more interesting thing here is the challenge for Cruz to some extent is likability, right? He's always had that problem. I think what he wants to try to do is define O'Rourke in such a negative way that it sort of drives people out against him. I think he would be better off, frankly, just being, you know, reminding people why they initially voted for Ted Cruz, right? He was energetic. He was pushing a legitimate conservative cause. He was sort of, he talked about freedom and liberty a lot. I think the high energy, forward thinking Ted Cruz is the strategy he should take. Mm-hmm. At least based on what we've seen so far, his inclination is to go after O'Rourke, which I think is a mistake.
See, I disagree a little bit. I think that Cruz's approach here is more troublesome than it was early in 2012. No one knew who he was, so he could kind of come in tabula rasa. Now he's got baggage, and so he's got to be able to sort of choose one of these avenues. But I do think that I agree that he needs to be clear about where the line is ideologically. He needs to pin O'Rourke down to his most liberal policy positions. I think, frankly, if you're Cruz, one debate would have been preferable because you want to be able to say, I can name five things that O'Rourke's positions he holds that are very, very liberal, and leave it at that, right? Drop the mic and walk away. That, I think, has been working. Now, looking at some of the recent polling suggests that you have the coalition, the traditional Republican coalition. You've got women, you've got men, and you've got suburban voters who are all breaking for the Republicans. So he seems to be using this kind of grandstanding in a positive way. Here's the trouble for O'Rourke, and for Cruz, that 93% of people have made up their minds already, according to the Quinnipiac poll. If that's the case, then I think Cruz needs to go for a knockout blow and then effectively just take a knee so that you can limit your damage. Because more debates here means potentially that O'Rourke can rise up and be sort of his charming self, right, and ingratiate himself to people. But it also means that something like crazy could happen in D.C., right, or Trump could do something weird, and all of a sudden you're playing defense. So Cruz's positions, I think, yeah, leaves him little room to maneuver, but I think he's got a trajectory.
Well, I mean, for O'Rourke, I think he's going to try to emphasize what he has been, right? Which is compromise, bipartisanship, yeah. Willingness to listen to all sides. You may not agree with him on all the positions, but he's likable, and most importantly, he's willing to work with you. And I think that's what he is going to sell. And that's one of those things where, you know, it's sort of, we'll use the boxing analogy, the Ali Frazier argument. You know, if Cruz is going to be Frazier, he's going to come hard at him. O'Rourke's looking to counterpunch. He's looking to essentially absorb those blows and take them back, essentially take those positions and make them an asset for him. I agree with you. I'm really dubious about the polling in this race for a couple of reasons. There's two ways to look at it. The Quinnipiac poll in particular was a likely voter poll of a sample of what we would traditionally see in what you would call kind of a midterm base election. For Republicans, that's what they want. They want this to be a base versus base election. They have a structural, you know, 1.5 to 2 million vote advantage, game, set, and match for Ted Cruz. For Democrats, it's about widening to the electorate, making it larger, making it broader. If you get that, which is what you had been seeing in some of the other special elections around the country, and SD19 notwithstanding, yeah. O'Rourke's got a pathway. So I think the race is probably not a 9-point race, probably like a 5-point race. And we don't know what could happen in three of these. Ted Cruz could make himself look worse than he is currently viewed by some. O'Rourke is, in some ways, we talked about this, introducing himself to people. If his charisma and charm that has been winning people over in these rallies wins people over on the debate stage, then he might have an opportunity. Cruz has got a decent sized lead. He's trying to go four corners here, so I'm not sure I agree on the knockout punch. He just doesn't want to lose. And I think if you overextend and make yourself out to be something, you could give O'Rourke an opportunity to hit you hard.
Well, we'll see how good a Cruz's right cross is, right? But I think it's pretty good. In a debate like this where you've got a kind of fixed period to present and you've got a moderator who brings things in, I think that plays to Cruz's strength. Enthusiasm is O'Rourke's friend. 48% of Democrats say that Trump has made them more active compared to 29% of Republicans. So that enthusiasm is real. Talking about Trump, I think, helps O'Rourke because Trump's numbers are basically split in Texas, led by independents who disapprove of Trump 58%. So talking about Trump and that, I think, is something that helps O'Rourke. Also talking about health care. Of all the issues that are polled, economy, immigration, gun policy, Cruz wins, except on healthcare. So healthcare needs to be, I think, the one thing that he really hammers home. And O'Rourke can afford to play the long game here. You've got three debates. The second debate's going to be a town hall where he's going to shine. So he doesn't need a knockout in the first round. He can afford to do a little bit of a dance, right? It's the Ali strategy, right?
The rope-a-dope,
right?
The rope-a-dope, yeah, right? Exactly.
Let him punch himself out. Let him, you know, do his thing and then play for the next one because there's going to be a lot of attention, but there's going to be more to come.
And that third debate, I think, is going to be the final one. That's where you'll see all of the eyes and attention be on it. But I think it's interesting. Three debates, a lot of attention, and we'll see what happens next. Well, that's it for this week. Party Politics is recorded in the George B. Geary Performance Studio at Houston Public Media.
Big thanks to our coordinating producer and our Rock of Gibraltar, Ernie Manous. Special kudos to our web and graphics team at Houston Public Media. And finally, thanks to our audio engineer, Todd, the great debater, Holstander.
I'm Jay Iyer.
And I'm Brandon Rottinghouse. We'll see you next week.